Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your hosts, Jim Person and Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Hello, Knife Junkies, and welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Jim Person.
And I'm Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco. Welcome to the podcast.
Welcome to episode number 56 of the Knife Junkie Podcast, the place for knife newbies and knife junkies to learn about knives and knife collecting and hear from knife designers, makers, manufacturers, reviewers, anyone who loves knives. And Bob, a different interview, if you will, today, more of kind of getting into your love of martial arts and that type of thing with our interview today.
Oh, that's right. Today I speak with Ron Kazakowski. He's the owner of Practical Self-Defense Training Center in Waterbury, Connecticut. He's a Kung Tao practitioner, Pakiti Tershakali, all the Filipino martial arts he's been training for years and years. But I initially got in touch with him because he owns a company called Traditional Filipino Weapons, or TFW as they go. And it is a company that he started with some smiths down in the Philippines. They do exactly what the name implies. They make traditional Filipino weapons, swords, knives. They even have that battle axe. I can't remember what it's called now. But he's been going down to the Philippines for years and looking at museum pieces and really investigating, finding all the different kinds of blade styles through all those different islands, very blade-oriented culture, and just reproducing them with high fidelity and high production techniques, you know, down there. And then importing them back here. And it was just interesting to talk to him about his martial arts experience, but also his experience in running a business, making knives in the Philippines, knives and swords.
Right.
And, how you grow a business like that.
And you guys just jump right into it, man. Just start talking off that martial arts stuff, that which I can't even pronounce some of the different kinds.
Yeah. We do get into it a bit, but he's an interesting guy, and yeah, I think he makes it approachable. You know, you don't have to be a martial arts practitioner to get what he's talking about.
I want to remind you that if you like to save money on gas purchases, well, you'll need to get the Get Upside app. It's your way to get cash back on your gas purchases. Get Upside is an app you put on your smartphone whenever you need to get gas. You just search your area for savings, claim your discount, fill up the tank. Then all you have to do is take a picture of the receipt with your smartphone. It's that easy. You've just got cash back. You can get the app by going to theknifejunkie.com/save on gas. That's all one word. Get the app. Start saving today. theknifejunkie.com/save on gas.
You know you're a knife junkie if you're as happy as a kid on Christmas morning when that new knife arrives in the mail.
I'm here with Ron Kazakowski, owner and head instructor of Practical Self-Defense Training Center in Waterbury, Connecticut. They specialize in Filipino martial arts, Kung Tao, Santo Kali, Pakiti Tershakali, and they also teach Jeet Kune Do. But he is also the owner of TFW, formerly Traditional Filipino Weapons, an outstanding business, whose work I own a few of. They make incredible Filipino weapons down in the Philippines and import them up here. Ron, thanks for coming on the show.
Oh, thank you for having me. This is I'm very honored for this.
So what is Kung Tao?
Kung Tao, my version is from the Philippines. It originated in China. And, when the Shaolin temples were broken up, basically, especially in the Fujian provinces, and elsewhere too. And they, a lot of the martial artists, you might call them that, the monks, they separated and had to find work, of course. And when it got, a lot of them became sailors and business people, very ambitious, hardworking people. So they brought Kung Tao to Southeast Asia through trade. Just opening up something and teaching somebody down there, not even just trade, it evolved from there. Kung Tao would have adapted basically back then, to the existing weapons, the existing way they fight, there and everything. So, basically that's what it is. Kung Tao and Silat basically mean the same thing. It's just a different dialect, you might say.
So for people who aren't martial artists, what characterizes this kind of art or the Filipino martial arts in general?
I like to say Filipino martial arts is, especially Kung Tao, is like the way ancient man would fight like an animal. to survive, basically. And, you know, it goes all out. You could kill, you could maim. Considering the fact that Kung Tao was Buddhist at one time, it's now Islam, actually, but they still hold on to the Buddhist roots, where you'll see, especially the elders and myself for that matter, you take it as far as it should go. So there's a lot of ethics and morals that are involved with it, you know. You don't want it because somebody called you an asshole or something. You don't want to be taking out his eyes and his throat, you know. But, you know, if he comes at you, you control him to the degree he came at you with, so to speak. If it's, you know, he comes at you with a weapon, of course, you're going to have to potentially kill him or cripple him, you know. That's the thing.
So minimal necessary force, like any martial art, but you want to be able to
defend yourself,
go as far as they're willing to go.
Yes, yes.
So I was watching some videos before talking to you. I'm familiar with Kung Tao through my own training a little bit. And then I saw the movements. I was like, oh, that's Kung Tao. Oh, that's Kung Tao. And it all is characterized by flow to me. It's just like, is this really easy flowing, not easy, but very flowing situation from one move into another, always kind of adapting to what the other guy's doing.
Yes, yes. So we always say you go off of human nature. For example, if I go to strike either with a hand strike or a foot into the groin, you're gonna move, even if it doesn't hit you. You're gonna move somehow. So it's gonna leave another part of the body wide open, and we respond accordingly. You know, and it's probably like any martial art, really. You know, that's what they all were like that one way or another at one time. And a lot of things got watered down through sport, you know. That's basically, if you want to call that watered down. I mean, not anything against sport, because I teach that side also.
Well, what's your school like? Explain what you do there.
Well, we have the MMA program, which consists of my Jeet Kune Do, Muay Thai, and what I call integrated grappling systems. It's just, I went all out studying, mostly with Larry Hartzell, a lot with Eric Paulson, and anybody I could grab. I worked a lot with the whole Gracie family at one time, it seemed like, you know, including them, quite a few of the Machados, a lot of other people also. I had, you know, some judo instructors, John Pereira, Sid Kelly, I've worked with, and so I just put my ideas together in an integrated form. And my son, who's an MMA champion right now, who's doing very well, is basically, he's utilizing that stuff, and he's beating a lot of people with it. So he's doing fantastic. So I feel it works, you know.
You teach a lot of blade, a lot of sword and knife. What's that? That comes from Kali, right?
Yes. The Kali and the Kung Tao both have that. The Kung Tao blade is different than the Kali blade a little bit, because, you know, there's a certain way that Kung Tao fights, certain way that Kali fights. Is one better than the other? I always say it's whatever you fall into, you know. And if one style, you know, overrides another one at that moment, then you do it, you know. That's all,
yeah.
You know? So it's hard to, because a lot of people ask me if there's one better than the other. Kung Tao is more involved, I think, covers more area, I think, in self-defense aspects, but, you know, they both cover quite a bit. They're both very vast, you know.
So I'm interested in that concept of self-preservation versus self-perfection in training. And a lot of the times you look, you know, like looking at the Kung Tao videos, and you're just flowing from one lock to the next, to the next, to the next knife defense. And a lot of people look at those kind of flow drills and think, that's not how fights happen. That's unrealistic. To that, I say, well, that's more a matter of self-perfection. You're learning how to flow in and out of these techniques. Mm-hmm. And no, fights aren't choreographed and don't go like this. But, you know, it's how you apply each little transition in real life that makes the difference. Explain to me that difference between self-perfection and self-preservation.
Well, I mean, without self-perfection, you're not going to have self-preservation. So, you could maybe learn a few moves, you know, from, say, like a style Krav Maga, maybe, or something, palm somebody in the nose, knee them in the groin, end the fight, but it's not covering everything that an ancient warrior system covers. The thing is, like, with all those moves, like, say, one of our lock flows, for example, in Kung Tao, there's probably like 20-something moves, 26 moves or something altogether, right? And broken down into sets of fours. And yes, you're not going to, you know, go from one lock to another like that. Although it is possible because you go to grab somebody, say, for example, and they move out of the way, try to stop it. You're going to try to go to the alternative move, which, and a lot of times, like our lock flow has, you learn the lock flow. Then what happens? You learn the strikes off of each lock in case of failure. And there's takedowns. There's probably a couple takedowns each move in the lock flow. Things like that. So, you know, there's like a step-by-step process. That's what I like about Filipino martial arts, too. It, you know, it's an unstructured structure, you might say. You know, it really teaches you how to, you know, get the muscle memory, the reflex development, you know, through all these. And then you go random with it all. And you try to basically take each other out as best you can without ruining the student. You know, you need to collect his money every month, you know. So, you know, so that's basically how you do it. You know, it's just a lot of flow, basically.
It's like jazz.
Kind of.
In a way, you're improvising.
Yes.
Well, so how did you get to traditional Filipino weapons, which is now TFW, because you've branched out from just traditional Filipino weapons that you're making? Tell me how that all got started and how you got hooked up with the Smiths down there.
Okay, well, this is a real good story, actually. When I went to the Philippines the very first time, I met a friend. His name is Apollo, actually. And, he knew the Philippines pretty well because he lived out there. He's actually a Filipino himself. And he brought me around where he thought all the blades were and everything. And we did. We went around. We got a few blades. I still have some of them. Some of them I've given away because of what I have now, you know. But it was like basically not very well made, you might say, you know. I met this one guy who made karambits, actually. And just before I even go on, they don't like to be known. That's the thing, because there's a lot of government problems, if you understand the Philippines at all.
Sure.
Somebody owns a business there, something going on, anything could happen, and, you know, we don't need any problems. And he doesn't want to be known just by other people trying to rip him off and everything else. It's like a cutthroat thing going on, you know, in some instances, because people are jealous. There are a lot of jealousy of TFW. But when I saw him with the karambits, it kind of blew my mind how nice they looked. They had a mirror finish on them. They were razor sharp. And back then, he just made them out of 5160, actually. And he gave me a box full of them because I said, oh, I think I could sell these. I said, can you make some and, maybe get me something and I could sell them. So he gave me a whole box full, which was a lot, quite a few thousand dollars worth, you know. And on a handshake, we went into business. I sent him back the money, everything, and we're talking via telephone. Back then, you had to get one of those cards, you know, those Asian cards, and I mean, whatever, they had the European cards and everything back then, and whatever you wanted to call, and it was a little bit cheaper to talk to them, you know, so we did business constantly like that, so I had to constantly spend money on those cards so we could do the business, and we were in touch on what we wanted to make. I think I started off with the Gununting, of course, because I was Bikini Terja. The Panute, the Chris swords, the Campalan, things that are more popular, you might say. Yes. And I sold those right away. On my first week in business, I was selling them. I couldn't even believe it. I never stepped in something and came out smelling so well. You know, it was like,
well, who are you selling them to? Your students and others in the community?
Some students did buy it, but because I've been with Tuhan Guru Dan and Larry Hartzell, Vunak, and I knew everybody in Filipino martial arts. I was playing around with Edgar Salite back then. I was doing a lot of different people I was training under. So I met so many people over the years that, and I kind of kept in contact with them more or less. I think back then there were only forums. I don't even think MySpace existed yet. You know, so we kind of were in touch through the forums, and then MySpace came, and all of them got in touch with me. And as soon as MySpace came in, I got blown off the mat. I couldn't even keep things in stock. And so we started looking around in museums. And, museums was the big thing. We started investigating museums like around here. They had an arms museum in Springfield, Massachusetts, for example. Small Filipino section. So we took pictures and talked to the curators. They wouldn't let us look at them, but hold them or anything like that. So I took pictures and approximate lengths and widths and all this stuff, and sent the pictures back. And he kind of, some of them blades he knew about, some of them he didn't know about. So we had to do the best we can. Then I just kept going to museums wherever I was. Went to one in Philadelphia, Museum of Natural History in New York City, and we have museums here in Connecticut. And then I started going to the museums in the Philippines, as many as I could possibly do, and taking pictures and trying to get more and more of the blades from the Philippines and trying to find what they were, and bring them back to life. Now, the museums didn't even know what they were. That's the funny part, because I say, do you know the name of that? And they didn't even know. I said, do you know the martial art, potentially what was behind it? They didn't even know that. So a lot of my blades, where I found out the name of them with help from people like on Facebook, some of them, I said, do you know what this is? I put it, this is quite a while ago on Facebook too, 2008 or maybe even earlier. And I say, do you guys know what this is? Does anybody know? And they tell me what the name of it was. If three or four answers, then we kind of figured, okay, that's got to be what this is,
Yeah.
Not all of them, because some of them had the names in the museum, which helped.
Let me interrupt you there and just say that I think it's really kind of funny that it took you doing investigation in the United States museums to find these blades. I know the Philippines, it's an archipelago, many, many islands, many, many different blade styles.
Yeah.
But what a great way to actually, harvest all that information, just hitting up the museums.
Yeah, well, I'm not the only one that did the investigation. He also did. When I was with him, sometimes we'd meet an elder guy that had, different rusted out blades or something like that. And, and he'd say how he used it in his family system and, how they wiped out the Japanese. There's a lot of, Filipinos have that story, And, that helped also. Some of the, especially like the ceremonial blades. I have the originals, actually, the ceremonial blades. And they're all rusty and crusty, and I got them downstairs in my room, down there, and where I display them, because to me, I'm proud of them. Those things could have killed somebody.
Yeah,
that's cool to me.
Yeah, when I lived in New York, there used to be flea markets on Sixth Avenue on Saturdays and Sundays,
yeah,
and
yeah.
I would go, and that's where I got my. I have a beautiful old Barong, the real deal. I have this
really?
This Chris, and I have a something that looks like a Garib knife, basically, and a couple of others, and they were all bringbacks from U.S. military, and I can't help it, all except for my Chris, which seems a bit ceremonial. They all seem like real just working tools that were probably put to use as weapons.
Yes. And it's cool to know, because to think about something that's 100 years old or more, it was used, one way or another. So somebody either died having that blade, or they killed somebody with it, maybe even multiple people with it,
I want you to finish your story. So you investigate, you find all these different blades from all over the Philippines, and you're sending these pictures back and forth to your partner down in the Philippines.
Yep.
How does it develop into the panoply you've got?
Well, it was a slow process as time went on. We just kept building up more and more. And then people started asking us, hey, can you make a kukri? Can you make, a claymore? Can you make this? Can you make that? And I asked him about it. I said, I had a picture of a claymore, actually, that I saw actually in the Arms Museum in Springfield. I think that's where I thought they had a whole bunch of different types of designs. And they had the Braveheart sword, things like that,
yeah.
That they're called the Braveheart sword, although the curator said nobody really knows what the true one looked like, but I took a picture of what they had, and I said, pretty much. This, you know, it's got to be it. And we started doing more and more. That's where we built on to all these other different swords that we have now, too. You know, I don't know how to use them all. I mean, through my Filipino martial arts, I'm assuming I could use any sword, you know, of course.
But a claymore is so different to compared to a Filipino.
Yeah. It doesn't even feel comfortable to me, but there's so many people I met that do that type of thing, and they, you know, they do the acting and all that stuff, you know, for the shows and everything, and they're really comfortable with it. They get their hands on it, they wield it around like it's nothing, and I'm like, wow, they're.
Well, I have the Roman Gladius made by TFW, and I think that's how you and I first got in touch recently. Was I put up a video just showing it off. It was a generous gift from my brother, who's given me so many cool blades. And this Gladius is amazing. It's bigger than I expected. I thought they were shorter, but this is like a cavalryman's Gladius, if that existed.
I think they did have a couple different sizes. One, like the length that we used, they used when they had their formations. I like to call it the triangle formations that they used to go in, and then they kind of went like that and closed in on the enemy. And that seemed to work for them for over 100 years. So, you know, I guess it's a good one, whatever they used. So, and then there was the shorter ones, I think, that were carried by the layman that for self-defense.
This Gladius, the thing that surprised me about it is that the handle is perfectly cylindrical in your hand. And, I mean, it lends itself to turning and twisting as you wield it or as you make impact. And I mentioned that in my video, and you came back saying, no, they really did have this circular handle. That's kind of an odd feature, I think.
From what I saw, like I said, in the museums and everything, it says that it looked like they were round handles. And I've heard that actually before. So it's not just you that said that. So other people have said the round handle, but what I saw was a round handle.
Yeah.
So I don't know the reason why, you know, they use that. I never seen them in an oval shaped handle, unless I'm completely mistaken, which I don't think, because you know all the pictures I took and everything back then, and you know, who knows where those pictures are now? They're probably in some. I got like 7 or 8 external hard drives. I kept dumping stuff on, you know.
So describe what it's like being down in the Philippines and going to one of these smiths. Do they make all of the swords for TFW in one location? Describe what that's like.
It's actually in a couple different locations just because of theft and people stealing ideas. That has to be done. We've had problems with employees in that way before, believe it or not. And we do keep, I definitely take care of everybody that works for us. My partner down there, he takes care of everybody, makes sure everybody, you know, the kids, we give extra, things like that to these people to make sure that, you know, they work hard and everything. And, you know, the machine, it started off with like hardly nothing, a grinding machine. One of the things that were running on a car battery, you know, at one time. And, you know, I know it was like, this is at the beginning, you know, but as we evolved and started spending more money goes far down there, you know, American money anyway, it goes far down there. So, they kept, especially in those days when the value of the dollar, I think it was like, probably 32 cents to a dollar or something like that. So when I was sending money back, they were able to evolve and get more machinery, and now it's like a whole factory, actually. It's not like a factory you'd see, you know, down the street from you. I'm talking about, you know, it's kind of not a jungle setup, but it's like, you know, in the middle of nowhere, you know what I mean? That's the thing.
That's pretty cool.
And we keep like a village of people working, you know?
That's amazing. And what are they making? They're creating some of the best modern interpretations of their historical, you know, of their heritage, of their legacy.
Exactly. I get so many emails. It's amazing how many emails, even on Facebook or even, I remember off of MySpace also. I get a lot thanking me for keeping their history alive, because it's dying out through electronics and, you know, even how I got in with the Kuntalas, the Maranao tribes down there, when I was talking to them, I said, you know, they told me that they never, ever worked with anybody outside their, let alone their tribe. I'm not Islam. I'm not Filipino. And they worked with me because, I mean, I talked to them. And one day I go like this. I said, well, everything is, you know, kind of getting screwed up. It's not what it used to be when you were a kid. Now, like these kids don't want to do what you did. I said, because of electronics. They want to be in front of the TV. They want to be on their phones. They want to, you know, they want to play video games. And they all looked at each other and nodded. And I went, yes, I did it. That was the key thing to say. And I'm telling them, I want to preserve their history. I'm writing a book on it too, on Kuntal.
Oh.
So, yeah. So that's the thing that they want that history to be alive. If anything dies out, they want some of it to be alive for generations to come, you know, and it's unfortunate. Well, even Kuntal out there is getting watered down, you know, so it's, you know, it's something that's needed. You know, we got to preserve their history.
Are these blades made with any sort of traditional techniques? I mean, or maybe they were when you were running everything off a car battery, but explain the process of making these things.
I export the steels. Which is getting overly expensive, you might say, because of the tariffs and everything. I knew I'd be the first one hit with those tariffs. You know, not to speak politics or anything like that, but I just don't like the tariff thing because the business was established 25 years ago or more with that thing after NAFTA was put in. That's real expensive, you know, exporting it and then importing the blade. So I had to go up on my prices just to make up for it because it wasn't worth it after all this happened, you know, and nobody complained. So really, I thought it was going to affect me. It didn't affect me because I'm selling just as many with having that, you know, with that tariff that's put on when it wasn't. So it doesn't matter. I might have been selling them too cheap. A lot of people told me I was selling them too cheap. You know,
I actually thought they were incredibly reasonable.
Yes.
And they actually still are.
Yes, they are. I mean, if you see a knife that's not even as nice as our Pakal knives, you see them at a knife show and, you know, they're charging like $600 for the thing, you know.
Yeah.
So, you know, I mean, you know, I'm charging, you know, less than half that for it, you know.
So two things about Filipino blades. The blade and the handle. I know that sounds crazy, but they both, I mean, if you just take a look at the blades across the board, there are so many different shapes, all aggressive, but there's such a wide variety of shapes. And the same thing with the handles. The handles on Filipino knives and swords are so beautiful and so ergonomically attuned. You know, they know exactly what they're used for and how to keep them in your hand. And they end up making them beautiful. Tell me about how those handles are shaped and where that wood, you use exotics and everything. Tell me about that.
Okay. One thing people don't know about Filipino blades and the styles that are behind those blades. The thing is, the style is adapted to a particular blade that they use. Our Pakiti Terja system, for example. The Florete is probably different than a Florete movement from another style. A Panute Florete is going to look different than a Gnunting Florete because we can use that last 3 inches of back edge during the use of the Florete, where you'd have to do a little slight hand adjustment when you're using a Panute for the same movement, just as an example. A lot of the knife, the handles, the shape, what they do with the blade and the handle, especially if it has some sort of, I like to call it a skull crusher on the end. You know, a lot of times you'll see something in a style that has to do with the movement of the skull crusher combined with the knife or the sword, you know. And basically, that's why you have, they all look alike in style, but there's a lot of different styles. And yet there's subtle differences between each style. And it all has to do with that certain blade. Now, nowadays, everybody adapts their style to a stick. You know, so if you just have a stick style, pretty much you know, the basics are there, it's going to work anyway, you know. That's what makes the difference there. Some blades are for basically just slashing or hacking. And then there's some blade, like, you know, you look at the Wargalock, for example. It's got that flat edge. That's going to be pure hacking, like almost like a hatchet. And, you know, you could basically, you know, damage somebody with armor with that.
You have a video on YouTube of you chopping a giant limb off a tree with that thing. It's like a big, long rectangle with sharp edges. It's beautiful in its simplicity.
Yeah, it's a crazy blade. It's ugly, but it sells well. People love that blade, you know. You know, I always thought, when I first got one, I said, I don't think many people will buy it, but they did, you know. People like it. It looks primitive. I have one that's over 100 years old that had killed 4 bodies. They got the ashes of the bodies on the blade itself, embedded with Philippine indigenous glues and saps, and they let it sit on the sheath to capture the spirit of the person, because everybody's a warrior. They're still warriors whether they lived or died. They're still warriors and they're respected. And it was put onto the sheath, and it even smells like death. I was told not to let too many people touch it, which I don't, you know. I'm the only one that really handles it now, you know, and it was given to me as a gift. And to me, it's priceless. I would never sell that, you know.
God, that's so gangster.
Yeah.
I mean, that is just... So you said everyone's a warrior. What's the warrior ethos down there in the Philippines?
Well, I mean, they're modern just as much as the United States now. When I first started going to the Philippines, there wasn't as much as there is now. But, I mean, you're in the city. They're just like me and you. I mean, really, you know what I mean? Out in the province, they're just hardworking people. And there are arguments that break out, you know, drunken arguments, I get, from what I understand, mostly. Rape you don't see that much of, because what's going on is if you do, especially in a province, and you rape somebody, you're probably going to turn into fertilizer, you know, so you'll never be seen again. So you don't see things like that, you know.
Well, I mean, what about the spirit in the culture, that warrior spirit? I mean, you said everyone's a warrior, and you teach an ancient martial art. So is there something in the culture reaching back?
All right. Well, when I said everybody's a warrior, I'm talking about, you know, of course, the wielder of the sword that was fighting and he lost and his body ended up on the sheet. But right now, you don't see a lot of people out there don't even know about it. You know, I'll bring it up. I remember talking to a few different people and they go, oh, our niece, they go like this. They make Sinawali motions. They say, because that's what they learned in school. You know, they're trying to, I guess this president is trying to make it like more part of the culture and bring it back or something, or people involved with the president are doing it, from what I understand. So I guess it's going to come back, but you're never going to see the ancient times where, you know, somebody visited this melting pot and, you know, they got defeated and then went back and tried to do trade or whatever. You know what I mean? You're not going to see that anymore. Everything, the whole world is open now, especially, you know, because of the internet. So a lot of this is getting forgotten about it, and the old ancient warrior ways, which really was everybody back in, you know, 100 years ago and further. Everybody was a warrior back then. You know, the blade was the reason why everybody survived.
There was a lot of invasion happening, and there was a lot of maritime activity, a lot of sailing around the world. So there's influence in the Filipino martial arts, influence coming from China and Japan and Spain and Italy, all over the world, right?
Yes. The biggest influence was actually China, then India, because even the Philippines, long before Islam was even there, was Hindu. Then you got, you know, of course, European nations that started going down there because of trade. You know, they brought back spices from that area, and they were in big demand, of course, you know, and there's a lot of exotic foods that they have there that, you know, people didn't have in Europe. So Spanish, of course, they spread their ways, especially the religion and everything, all over the world. And, you know, Philippines was one of them. And, you know, it's got quite a, there's a, I mean, I speak, when I speak with Dan Anasanto, and he he talks about it. And I sit there and I go, really? I mean, there's African Aborigine influence.
Yeah.
I mean, the list goes on. He talked about Aztec influence because when the Spanish were in Spain, when the Spanish were in Mexico, whatever it was called back then, and then what had happened is some of the Aztecs worked on the ships with them, and they traveled back and forth to the Philippines. So there was a little bit of trade. I don't know much about that, but I was just fascinated to hear that.
Guru Dan will bring a sword, a Zanzibar sword.
Yeah.
And that's African, but they use it with a Spanish style. I remember him saying something like that.
He says that, but in my research, I don't find that with the Zanzibar. Now, he says the Zanzibar comes from Zanzibar. Okay. I cannot find that. I can't even find anything that looks remotely the same in their swords, in comparison to like the Zanzibar. And why they would call Zanzibar and it sounds like Zanzibar, I don't know. A lot of people call the sword the Zanzibar, you know, just because, either through, you know, Guru Dan's, influence or because that's what they've heard of, you know. It's up upper right hand side of Zanzibar is up the upper right hand side of Africa. They're almost in the Middle East. And I don't see any influence, but then again, I can't find the origins of the Zanzibar. And you know, when I speak to people and they say no, really nobody knows. If somebody does know, I'd love them to, you know, contact me and get a hold of me. Anybody who's a historian on this, I'd love to learn more myself because I'm still learning. I don't call myself an expert. I just want to, you know, I do know a lot, but I want to learn more, you know.
Tell us how many TFW blades are there? And beyond the Filipino weapons, what else do you make? I know you make the Gladius, but what else?
We have of course, the Gladius, the Celtic sword, those are the two more, you know, over 3,000 year old blades. Then we've got the more, if you want to call it modern European, you know, like the archer sword, the crusader sword. The archer sword is an amazing feeling sword. If you're a Filipino martial artist, you play with that and you'd love the way that feels because it's so light and beautiful. The archer sword is actually because when the archers ran out of arrows, they had a fight with their sword. Their number one fighting method was with the arrows, and that's what they practice all the time, but they also practice with the sword. Hmm. Of course, you know, we mentioned before the Braveheart sword, the Claymore. I'm not sure if I said the Kukri. We just came up with the Indonesian Karambit also. There's one Karambit that we have. A lot of people say there's no Karambit in the Philippines, but in southern Philippines, there's Indonesian influence to their martial arts. That's why they look so similar. You know, it even calls silat just like they do in Indonesia. Kuntao, just like they call it in Indonesia also.
Oh, you got that Bowie. You have a new Bowie knife.
Oh,
that's so
the American
cool
one. Yes, the Bowie. And supposedly there's supposed to be Filipino influence to that blade. I was reading something that Jim Bowie had a Filipino wife. And imagine that.
Well, I always thought it came from the Navaja, so maybe through Spain through the Philippines to Jim Bowie.
Yeah, that's what it could have been. I read different things, but when I read that, I thought that was quite fascinating, and there's got to be some sort of truth behind it. It's just research in the web nowadays is like pulling teeth. Because everybody has their opinions,
and yeah. Well, what other non-Filipino knives or swords are you do you have in the hopper? What are you looking to make next?
Well, we want to make a tactical gununting. I have a new idea for a gununting to make something that's a real survivor's type of gununting. And I got some ideas that I don't want to talk about, like, you know, exactly mm-hmm. what the ideas are, but
sure,
it's going to
sure.
look, it's going to look nice. It's going to have a good skull crusher, a good, you know, you can use it for punching. It'll be like, not brass knuckles, but it'll have the hand guard to act like that. It's going to be rust proof. It's going to be, it'll be all black. We tried one before. I didn't like it. It was too heavy. There were certain things that I didn't like about it, and we couldn't find a way to make a sheath on it because what we did have the idea of is to put a saw on the back of it. And the saw, we couldn't sheath the damn thing because because
kept
of the
destroying
saw blade.
The sheath.
Yes, it would destroy the sheath, and no matter what we tried, I had engineers around here trying to figure out things for that, and it was just such a difficulty with, you know, trying to preserve it without ruining the sheath, you know. So that was it's not failed, you know. I got 25 of them. I put them on sale because I wanted to do something else and make a better idea. When I got those, I got a better idea, so I just sold them for, you know, a good price, and they sold right away. People like them, you know. We're gonna have the Krabi Krabong, so we're gonna have those swords.
Krabi Krabong is the double bladed Vietnamese
sword and staff. No, that's actually Thai. It's Thai, where Muay Thai actually came from. Is Krabi Krabong, and you know, supposedly 1,000 years ago they used to fight in a lower stance, and then they went more upright as time went on, and it became a very popular sport to this day, you know. Yeah. So we got another set of butterfly knives that we want to make too. One that was designed by Yip Man. I have a student who does Yip Man Wing Chun, so he had the exact replica of the it was a training knife, but it was the exact replica of his short one, and I feel that might be cool for people that might want to carry them to demonstrations or something like that, or just have them, and they do make a cool weapon if you're allowed to carry that in your state. you know, so there's a lot of ideas we have. It's just getting to them has been a problem because I keep selling out, and I'm trying to restock and keep it restocked, especially for Christmas time. And we're having a hard time getting to all the new stuff that we want to make, you know?
I bet.
It's driving me nuts.
I was just on the site, and, I haven't bought a Filipino sword in a while. And the next one on my list is the Talibang. It's one of my favorites.
Yeah.
And I have one hanging on the wall that my dad gave me a long time ago. But I just would love to have the one that traditional Filipino weapons makes. But you're sold out on that. You're sold out on a number of things. I was surprised you have Gununtings in stock. I know that's the most.
I had 100 made. And we only have 25 left or something like that for Christmas now, and that's it.
Get your Gununtings, you know? People. Get your Gununtings.
Exactly. They are my hottest seller. The Talibang also is. I don't think the Talibang's out of stock, is it?
Maybe it is on the website. Look.
Yeah,
you got the Lahut, so I might just get that.
Yeah, that's another nice one. Wait till you feel that. Talk about a fighting sword. It's definitely a good go-to sword. It's quick.
At the wrap-up of these interviews, I like to ask for funny knife stories or just knife stories in general. Do you have anything that pops to mind? Something that you may have experienced that people would benefit from?
Well, we all learn knife toe-to-toe, so to speak, right? So that's really not how knife fighting is. I've been stabbed in the back in a fight I got into back when I was like 22 or 23 years old, and I didn't even see it coming. I didn't even know I was stabbed until I got home, and the girl I was with at the time said, "Why do you have blood going all the way down your back?"
Whoa.
Yeah, and when I got stabbed, I ended up fighting 5 more people, you know, that night. I was quite different person back then. and I didn't even know I was stabbed, like I said. But the next day, I couldn't move for probably a good 5 days. I was on the couch. I remember watching Phil Donahue, and that's kind of outstanding. You know, it's like a lot of TV shows that I remember getting bored because I couldn't even move. To go to the bathroom was quite a task, you know.
Wow.
If that's a funny story, I don't know, but,
well, that's,
you know, it just shows you self-defense, knife self-defense. Good luck with it. You know, it's, you got to be able to have a good eye and notice that somebody's coming in to kill you.
Yeah. It's also a testament to the power of adrenaline. I mean, that's, there's no way if you were just chilling, you got stabbed in the back. You'd probably notice, right?
Yes, yes. I had a friend many years ago going back in time. He came out of Vietnam. He was all screwed up in the head, you know, and he told me that, you know, one of the first things that he saw was his friend there got like this side of his body, like cut off the arm and everything shot right off. And he got pissed off and ran out there with his I think it was an M16 they would carry. So he ran out there and he started shooting at anything, and he got shot down. And I thought of that, and I'm like, wow, you know, when your adrenaline is up, you know, it's, you look at an MMA fighter, what happens to them? They get their face pounded, but they're still standing and they're still doing it. Sometimes five rounds of that.
Yeah.
You know, adrenaline is a son of a bitch, you know?
Yeah. Well, so how do people find TFW, Traditional Filipino Weapons, formerly? How do you find your weapons and keep up with you?
Well, you go on traditionalfilipinoweapons.com. There is an area on traditionalfilipinoweapons.com where you could put your name and your email, actually, and you could get a newsletter from me. I recommend that, because if you're not on Facebook, and not everybody gets all your posts on Facebook and everything, so, or Instagram for that matter. So it's best probably to get the newsletter and actually open it up and look at it, you know, that's probably the best way, you know, is just to go on there and maybe connect with me, look up, TFW or the business page on Facebook. You'll see it there, or look up my name on, Facebook.
And you also have a beautiful website that has incredible, you know, really incredible pictures of the products and the weapons there. And you can buy them right from there. That's where I've gotten them, right? And that's the only place to buy them, is right on the website,
right? Yeah, that's the only place, yeah. Okay. Even people in the Philippines, which I ship probably almost every week to the Philippines. And I tell people, you know, from the Philippines, because they want to order, say, could I order directly here? I said, they don't want to be known. They don't, you know, so they don't. They're strict about that, because they already had problems. And so what happens is, you know, they got to order off the website. And they gladly do it, to tell you the truth, you know. So it's, you know, and if you want it, that's, you know, a lot of them put their name. I know there's a lot of Filipino email addresses in my, on the list too. So I guess they're into it, you know. They're glad to see their history put out there, you know. I don't blame them.
I look forward to reading your book. Good luck in finishing it up, and definitely let me know when it's finished. I will buy it and spread the word. Ron Kozakowski, thanks so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast.
Thank you very much for having me. It's quite an honor, like I said, you know. It's good to meet you more in person.
Subscribe to the Knife Junkie's YouTube channel at thenifejunkie.com/YouTube.
Back on the Knife Junkie podcast, Jim and Bob with you. And Bob, you know, great thing about having a podcast is you get to talk to these folks that you have a great interest in. And I think that this was one of them. I could kind of tell that, man, you were into this interview with Ron.
Well, I'm into all of them. I have interest with all of them.
True,
this touches a number of dimensions, you know, the martial arts aspect of it. And if you've ever seen Ron Kozakowski practicing his art, or if you have ever seen these arts in general, Kali, Kuntao, they are all about flow and, you know, going from one technique to another, you know, assuming one fails or one succeeds, you keep moving. And that's kind of what he was doing. I mean, talking about running a sword and knife business between here and the Philippines.
Right.
You better have a good idea of flow, because you're going to have to change and course correct constantly, especially when you're dealing with import laws and tariffs on materials and such. It's not as simple as it sounds, and it doesn't sound simple.
Just running a business is not simple. Then, as you said, you know, here, there, beyond, everywhere. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, like you said, his people try and lay low. You know, they don't want people to steal their designs. They don't want to attract any, unnecessary attention. And, you know, it's a kind of a big operation making all those things. So I bet there's a lot to it.
Yeah. Our podcast today is brought to you by Audible. If you like the Knife Junkie podcast, other podcasts, it's apparent that you like listening to audio, you can get a free audiobook download and a 30-day free trial of Audible just by going to the audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. That's audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. Over 180,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Again, audibletrial.com/knifejunkie. And Bob, as we wrap up episode number 56, our interview show of the Knife Junkie podcast, final word from the Knife Junkie.
If you have any interest in anything you heard on this podcast, look around. There might be a place you can train in this kind of stuff or something similar close to where you are. It really doesn't matter what you train in. You will feel amazing after you do it, and you'll become obsessed.
I know you already are.
Another obsession outside of knives. Good idea.
Right. All right. For Bob, the Knife Junkie DeMarco, I'm Jim, the Knife Newbie Person. Thanks so much for joining us on the Knife Junkie Podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram, and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487, and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.